Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
It's a Friday edition of Zero Block 30, and today we have five rounds in the magazine. Round number one, sometimes military acronyms get out of hand, and thus it's time to talk about Sierra, Papa, Oscar, Romeo, Tango, Sierra, the Air Force's hip new game plan to get you off the toilet in 5 minutes or less. Folks, this is Barstool Sports after all. We're going to talk about Air Force sports. Round number two, Master Sergeant Matthew Williams, an active duty Green Beret, received the Medal of Honor on Wednesday for actions during a 2008 Special Forces raid in Afghanistan that resulted in a seven-hour firefight. The story is incredible, and you have to hear it. Round number three, the Air Force isn't doing themselves any favors by introducing a new R device on their awards. We'll break down what that means and if it's a good idea or not. Round number four, the Marine Corps is overhauling their promotion requirements. Salty Lance Corporals will love it. Fast-tracking boot-ass staff NCOs will hate it. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. And finally, we're going to close out the show with an interview with Guy Sondgrass. He is Secretary Mattis's speechwriter who wrote a book called Holding the Line that talked about some of the behind-the-scenes actions. The book is making waves, so we invited Guy on to spill the tea.
Spill that tea. Love a little spilled tea on a Friday.
Yeah, we all love a little bit of a spilled tea. And all that today is going to be brought to you by our good friends at Roman. Roman Swipes, folks, I can't talk about them enough. They are a clinically proven way to last longer in bed. Con's, you a big pre-nut guy?
Mm-mm, no.
Same.
Pre-nut?
Yeah.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah, just come too quick. Yep. But sometimes you can't help it. For younger listeners, we do have a younger listening squad here. If you're 22 years old, 23 years old, I can't tell you how many times I get DMs. It's like, Chaps, my man, making out my lady, came in my britches. What should I do? Before you even start heavy petting, heavy making out, what you need to do, go into the bathroom, rip a pee, first of all. You got to get that out.
Yeah.
Clean out the old bladder. Mm. Secondly, you pull out your Roman swipe, you put that back and forth on your old willy, talking dicks now, and you will be lasting much, much longer, and you don't even require a prescription if you go through GetRoman.com/zero. You can get your first month for just $5 when you choose a monthly plan. Imagine your lady. You pull her in on something like Bumble. What's the newest one? Tinge.
Hop-a-tooties.
You pull her in on hop-a-tooties.com, and yeah. Next thing you know, you're having sex for the first time. She's like, how are you lasting this long? Am I not attractive? And you're like, no, I'm just a stallion in here.
Whew.
They don't call me Owen Gray for no reason.
Oh, how? Hello. Friday shout out. Hello. Owen Gray, if you don't know,
it's time
Google
the
it.
PEDs are not reserved for the professionals anymore.
Don't Google it on your work computer.
And you're going to be thinking about a couple weeks ago when we had the dinner on because, my friend, you are going to have a horse cock. That's good.
There's an elephant in the room that was addressed everywhere, but we cannot assume that all of our listeners are within the Barstool Sports world. Mm. And there was a major incident between Tuesday's episode and as we record now.
Right.
Chaps, what happened?
I forgot three sets of underwear because I was only supposed to be here
I'll give you guys a clue.
I came up to New York unprepared. That's on
new
me.
Glasses,
earlier in the week on maybe? Tuesday's episode, three of us had facial hair.
Mm-hmm.
And now only one of us. Wait, now only two of us do.
Mm.
Who is
well, it's
the...
still kind of three. You got a little bit of...
That's what... Oh, I'm saying. I'm so over 30. I'm
no
aware.
Longer four.
Yeah, true. All right. So, yeah, I shaved my beard. It was a huge mistake. I went back. I made a mistake. I'm man enough to admit it. I've admitted all over the place. I've been shamed, especially by Kate, which
How
was...
How you feeling? Let's talk about this. How are you feeling?
It was unbecoming of Kate, honestly. Like, I feel like I'm very supportive. Kate, not only whenever some pictures happen to take place, like if Khan's bald spot, for example, came up, that one came out of nowhere. I had a journalistic obligation to share that one. Kate went searching for the picture last night?
Well, so there was a video, and there was a moment where you turned your head. I was rooting for the Nats. You're rooting for, who's that team that's unimportant? Oh, the Astros. Mm. And they weren't doing well, the Astros. And you turned to look at me in a shade-type manner. And when you did, the way you were sitting in the chair and the lack of beard highlighted an unfortunate rippling of the chin.
Yes, people are saying I have a turkey chin.
And we've gotten all sorts of, people are saying you look like Mrs. Doubtfire now.
Mm-hmm.
Bubbles.
Big time Bubbles.
Mr. Krabs from the episode of SpongeBob SquarePants where he loses his shell.
Mm-hmm.
All sorts of different.
The one that I thought was very particularly mean was Pancake Batter with Eyes.
The kid from Polar Express.
Right.
All sorts of different comparisons are rolling in hot now.
The guy from the Goonies.
Baby Ruth Sloth. Wow. Sloth from the Goonies.
Hey, you guys.
But, you know, it's a good look. You look fresh.
Oh, God,
it's
Kate.
It's smooth.
Listen, I've yet to put my opinion out there publicly, and you actually made a note of that on radio this week. You said, you know, you hadn't heard anything from me, and this is what I'm going to say. Many years from now, many, many years from now, chaps, when you're dead and the obituary comes out, it's not going to talk about how you looked. It's not going to talk about a beard. It's going to talk about the impact that you made on this world and on your family. And I think that's what is important, and that is what we need to focus on.
No, I disagree. I think this is a major matter. This will be in there.
I was going to say, actually, and then the rest of us will be standing around about at your wake talking about that one time you shaved your beard and looked like a complete idiot.
Well, when I do die, I think this technically counts as a will. What I want to happen is that I want to be stuffed and shellacked like a Green Army guy.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to be the one with the medical detector.
Got it. I like that. I think you can have that.
That's a great wish. My skin green, so when everybody comes to my wake, I'm just standing there, just like hanging out, and I'm the Army dude.
I like that. Yeah. I'm a fan. I like it.
But Marine guy.
Okay. Well, I'll make him a Marine.
Let's make sure we get that correct.
We're going to get digital cameras. All right. Let's hop into the actual show because we got some good topics today, including a great interview at the end of the show. So make sure you stick around for that. And at the top of the show, I mentioned it on PMT on Part of My Take, Barstool's best sports podcast. But make sure that you're going to YouTube and searching for Zero Block 30 on YouTube. We have all kinds of interviews that are going on there, the best clips of the show, and some things that whenever we describe it, you'll actually get to see it. Round number one, we have an acronym, folks. We have acronyms all across the military, and this one is SPORTS, but it's not something that's going to keep you safe on a flight line.
Well, sounds cool.
Yeah, it's not something that's going to help you fire your weapon with precision and lethality. Mm. It's not going to do anything to that. The only thing that it's going to allow you to do is, I guess, take a shit.
An acronym in the Air Force that is making the rounds on the internet because this acronym was taped to a bathroom door, and it is SPORTS, sports.
Yes, and they broke it down a little bit further, sports, because every good acronym means something. Sports, the S is sit down and conduct your business. No need to be sitting for more than 5 minutes. The P is push and hold the handle to flush the toilet. The O is observe items being flushed to ensure they all go down. The R is to repeat the flush if necessary. T is to take time to clean up any mess that you made. And S is to secure all items before leaving. And finally, a note of wisdom at the end of this acronym. After washing your hands, avoid splashing water off soap all over the counter or mirror. If there is a paper towel available, wipe splatters around the sink. Leave the latrine in as good condition as you found it. Report a clog or malfunction. And as always, fly, fight, and win.
Whoa. On the surface, by principle, these
don't
are all
you dare
great...
defend. Don't you dare defend this.
No, let me finish. These are all great instructions. These are all good principles to have when using the toilet. But the fact that they need to put it in print, tape it up next to the bathroom, and instruct airmen how to use a toilet is a problem.
Holy micromanagement, Batman. Yeah, I mean, do they need? Basically, this is telling you, hey, don't shit on the floor next to the toilet. Shit in the toilet. And then somebody even wrote with a pen on it, be a sports star.
With a little star next to it. That was lovely.
And can we circle back to S real quick?
Sure.
Can we circle around the bowl back to the letter S? Sit down and conduct business.
Maybe some people are hovering And then there's too much plopping going on. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a plop.
Because there is a problem in military culture, and I'd say in American culture, period. People are butt pussies.
Yeah, they're like, very much germaphobes when it comes to their heinies.
They constantly have to make a nest. You're not a bird, my friend.
Oh, just I do make down. A nest.
Do you?
Big nest lady. Oh, for sure. It's not so much about the blowback, the drip back. It's about the noise if other people are in there.
Oh, you make
it. Oh, you make an in the nest. Not on the, no, he's talking about on the seat.
This is, I was going to go on that. I think that that's abhorrent. I think that it's just an absolute travesty of a move that you're so concerned that somebody's going to hear your piss or shit hit in the water that you have to waste that much toilet paper. The environment is suffering, Kate.
Yes. I will say we did that in Iraq, but that was more so to protect us from blowback on a porta potty.
That is also a concern because if you get the right kind of, I heard from friends of friends, if you get the right kind of plop down, the drip comes right back up. And if you're still a little
that's
open
a
from the push,
bidet,
that drip
that
could go right up your bee hole and give you some sort of horrible disease.
I would like to address the second part of the S. No need to be sitting for more than 5 minutes. Now, I get it with cell phones these days. People have the propensity to just sit on a toilet longer.
On a cold day when you get the seat warm.
Sure. And it's not healthy to be sitting that long. It actually can cause hemorrhoids. But please, do not tell me. Do not tell me how long I can be on a toilet. Because sometimes, if I'm ill or I've had a large meal, it might take more than 5 minutes
you
to get everything out.
You strike me as a settling in. You strike me as a newspaper under the arm. I see him in a couple hours.
So you know what I used to do way back when, before cell phones and reading things on your cell phone was very prevalent? I would print out articles from the internet and then go use
that
the toilet.
Whoa. Crazy person move.
My gosh, that is...
This is many years ago.
Out of control.
It's no different than bringing a newspaper.
What was your original read on the toilet? Do you guys remember?
No.
Oh, I do. The Far Side. We had this big book of Far Side cartoons when I was a kid.
Oh, you mean like growing up?
Yeah.
Sports Illustrated. Because my dad just kept all of Sports Illustrated next to the toilet.
We were so poor that I had to just read the back of the shampoo bottle.
Oh, I've been that desperate
before.
I
used to love it when we get a new shampoo bottle and I'd look for the longest word.
Of
all the different ingredients, and there's always this one that was
microtriglyceride,
like
polyethylene.
That one thing that's probably really, really good for my hair. My longest bathroom experience is always the airport because I don't like to be just sitting out there. I'd rather just go in there and smell everybody's stew and just sit in privacy for like an hour.
Sure, why not?
Until my legs fall asleep.
You go nose blind after a few minutes. You're okay.
You do.
But that's ridiculous. No need to be sitting for more than 5 minutes. Somebody commented on the post. A lady named Morgan said, "How dare you assume I can get my business done in 5 minutes? I eat Taco Bell."
I mean, that's
she's got
a great
point. I mean, and also, you don't want to blow out your O-ring if you're trying to get it out in 5 minutes or less.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's ridiculous. Pee, push and hold handle to flush toilet. No shit. Then again, I will say, even in professional settings, I used to work facilities in an office building, like professional business people. And so I would have to get the calls like, the toilet's this, the toilet's that. In the ladies' room.
You've come a long way.
Oh,
honestly.
Yeah,
like,
for
the
sure.
That you used to do before this job, like your stories are horrifying.
Oh, yeah. I would always be, I drop my badge in the toilet and I'd have to go. And I'd be like, well, I'm glad you took a dump in there, too, because now I have to fish out your fucking badge with a dumper in it. Yeah. So ladies are – people just walk away. Mm. I also, like, observe items being flushed to observe, like, to make sure they all go down.
I think that's polite because there are definitely times when people probably flush and walk away and they don't think, like, ooh, there's some floaters. And nothing worse than going into a toilet that's still got some stuff floating around in there.
This is TMI – okay, I'm gonna say it here on the podcast. I poop. I take dumpers. I do. I know it's
all
true.
Right, let's move on to round two.
Wait. So I was seeing this guy, and it was my first trip out there, and his toilet. You had to like really hold it down.
Yeah, every toilet's a
little
different.
I waited way, way late till the middle of the night when I was like, I can do this real discreet. Mm-hmm. I like slunk out and I take a dumper and I flush it. And I'm like, I had had a couple drinks that night. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't like full functioning, Kate. And so I leave. And then the next morning he goes in there and it occurs to me. I'm like, oh my God, I didn't. It was still.
Oh no. Oh no.
Not
like
great.
That's like a Dumber Dumber or Along Came Polly type situation. Not
so anyways,
great. How long have you guys been together?
It's only been a couple months, but long distance, and so
not long enough that was a comfortable situation.
Right, yeah. I was like, Anyway, so I could have used this sports. I could have used. I should have.
What I'd like to see you do, Kate, is print this bad boy out and laminate it. And just stick it. Well, you don't even have a fucking wallet to put it in.
No, it's true.
Carry a wallet.
I'll just pin it to my sweater.
All right, let's move on to round number two. It's a much different round.
Honestly, I could talk about poop stuff all day. It's sad. Round two.
All right, round number two, going a little bit of a different direction. We have a Medal of Honor recipient. Then Sergeant Matthew Williams was upgraded from the Silver Star to the Medal of Honor. And now let's listen to his Medal of Honor citation.
Matt Williams grew up in the small town of Birney, Texas. Very small town. He met Kate for the first time in elementary school. In college, he planned to pursue a career in law enforcement, but after 9/11, Matt decided his place was on the front lines of the war on terror. He wanted to be the best of the best. He worked so hard at it. So after graduation, he enlisted in the Army to become a Green Beret. Matt finished his Special Forces training in August 2007. And deployed to Afghanistan by October. On April 6, 2008, he joined dozens of American Special Forces and Afghan commandos on a mission to take down a terrorist leader in a remote mountain village. Sounded simple? Not simple. On that cold spring morning, the soldiers arrived in helicopters and jumped 10 feet from their Chinooks into the rocky and freezing terrain of Shock Valley. When the first Americans reached the edge of the valley, at the base of a 100-foot mountain, a handful of special forces scouted ahead. The lead group was 60 feet up the slope when roughly 200 insurgents savagely attacked, and it was a big surprise. Very unwelcome surprise, I might add. The terrorists filled the valley with a hail of bullets and explosions. Matt soon received word that the soldiers on the mountain were pinned down and suffering from mounting casualties. He organized the Afghan infantry under his command, and he led a bold counterassault to stop the enemy advance. As machine gun fire rained down from above, Matt and his fellow American soldiers, Scott Ford and Ronald Scherer, charged up the mountain. Once they reached their trapped comrades, Matt realized that several of them were too gravely wounded to be quickly evacuated. He ran down the mountain to get support and then climbed back up with bullets spraying all around. Not a good place to be. Again and again, Matt exchanged fire with the enemy and rescued his fellow soldiers. He guided his injured team sergeant, Scott Ford, down the mountain to safety. When Matt noticed two combatants moving toward a group of the badly wounded, he immediately engaged the enemy fighters and killed them both. But Matt was not done yet. In order to rejoin the battle on the mountain, he and Sergeant Seth Howard scaled a sheer cliff, completely exposed to attack. Matt quickly re-engaged the adversary and shielded the injured from falling rubble as American warplanes bombed insurgent positions above and rocked the mountain from top to bottom. He then helped evacuate the wounded down a very, very steep cliff. As the terrorists continued to try to overrun their position, Matt raced back into battle. He fought for several more hours, valiantly protecting the wounded and putting his own life in great peril to save his comrades. Matt's incredible heroism helped ensure that not a single American soldier died in the Battle of Shock Valley. His ground commander later wrote, "I've never seen a troop so poised, focused, and capable during a fight. And Matt is, without question and without reservation, one of the bravest soldiers and people I've ever met."
So just incredible act of heroism. And we're seeing now more and more, it seems like, these awards that are so deserving of the Medal of Honor being reexamined and rightfully heightened up to that level.
I wonder if they'll go back, because now I think they're currently doing it for, I believe it's Silver Stars and above is mm-hmm. where they're looking at to upgrade it to Medal of Honor, Navy Cross, or whatever. I wish they would go back even further, because I think some of these stories get lost, especially whenever you're dealing with junior enlisted, and that's because the way that the award system is, it's not designed to recognize junior service members. Mm-mm. It's just not. Like, the way that it's so dumb, I hate the award system, because it should be above your rank and experience level is what you get awarded for. That's not the way they do it. It's like you leave a higher command, so you're going to get a higher award. You're going to leave with a Defense Service Medal. You're going to leave with this or with that. You should get awarded if you are a lower-ranking person who does outside what would be expected of your rank and responsibilities.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I wish that they would go back and look at some of the NAMs and even some that weren't. Like, I've told the story before. One of my buddies, Polart, he jumped on a grenade at the glass factory in Ramadi. The grenade didn't go off, so he only got a NAM.
That's a little ridiculous to me, because like, he didn't know.
Right.
He didn't know that wasn't.
Still jumped on
like,
it.
Like, thank God it didn't. He's so lucky, but there was no way to know
and
that.
And they had witnesses and everything that saw him do it. Like, it got in a crowd. They threw the grenade out. He jumped on top of it and fully expected to end his life, and it didn't.
Yeah, and the fact that that's only a NAM is
it's crazy.
It should be even a little higher than that, but yeah, that's crazy.
Totally
but
crazy.
One thing that really struck me when looking at this story, though, too, the terrain, I think we forget sometimes, too, the terrain in Afghanistan, and Kate, you can speak to this, but I read it and heard it as he's running kind of like on boulders, not flat ground.
Oh, no, he's on a mountainside.
Yeah, he's on a mountainside, uneven ground. It's all ice covered and snow.
Enemy with higher ground on you.
Yeah,
and
unbelievable. And then the part where it reads about him going through a river, a rushing river with a current. Just think about like running in a pool when you're just goofing off in the summer and now add a strong current and people shooting at you.
And what struck me with this, too, was it's difficult enough to keep your mind, while all this is going on, and the fog of war, they say how confusing it is on the battlefield when shit's mm-hmm. really going down. He not only kept it together, he was doing, like, 40 different things at once.
Right.
He was rallying both the Afghan and American troops. He was helping the wounded. He was getting them stabilized. He was running back. He was suppressing fire. He was doing 20 million different things at once that had such a huge effect on this battle space, and it's just incredible.
The next time we have a Medal of Honor recipient that's on the show that's in a situation like this, because I think this is what like Flo and Groberg's situation was like as well, where it's just like intense combat for a long period of time, I want to talk to them about what their bodies felt like the next day.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, like, because you can be so stressed out in a situation like that and like just tense. Mm-hmm. Having your mind and your body focused and going for 7 hours, mm-hmm. what you must feel like with the lactic acid buildup the next couple of days has got to be paralyzing.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get through that first week after a 7 hour firefight? Like, crazy. What do you do?
Well, and not even just physically, but mentally too, to come down off of that adrenaline high, to then get back into a headspace where you can operate normally is just, I would be very interested to hear that as well.
Like, I was in some pretty decently long firefights, nothing 7 hours or anything like that. Like, even, but a firefight that is 90 seconds of sustained fire is an eternity.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an eternity.
Right.
I mean, when I was inside the house and there was mortar rounds dropping and we were waiting for the helicopter to come pick me up, it was a period of 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. That 90 minutes felt like 6 months.
I believe it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's
and
just
you're
like
laser beam focus.
Right.
It's like you think so much time is going by and you're like, oh, that was 5 minutes.
Right. Oh, right. Oh. It's like I think I equate it to, you know, when people, we talk about rough and rowdy and boxing, and most people don't ever just hit a heavy bag or like box someone for a minute straight and then three-minute rounds. So now you're talking about something like you're talking about Chaps were 90 minutes. You were laser focused in. What other walk of life or any other job is going to require you to do that at that level of intensity?
No, at that level, I don't think that there's anything. But I was thinking about that with John Smoltz actually last night during the broadcast. It's not obviously not the same. And like, if you're listening to the show, you don't think that I'm making that actual comparison to sports, the same thing as combat.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever Verlander is out there pitching, John Smoltz made the point. He's like, he's at 60 pitches now, but 60 pitches in the World Series is like 90, 95 in any other game.
Sure. Yeah.
Just because of the adrenaline that you have, the focus that you have to have, the concentration between every single pitch is just different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that applies to the military. Like, you can have 90 minutes chilling anywhere else is different. 7 hours of firefight, 7 hours of a work day. 7 hours of straight up getting shot at and doing all these heroic things is something that I'll never be able to understand. And obviously, if you're listening to the show, we are going to try to get Master Sergeant Williams on the show, because that was the second. There's two people from the same team that received the medal for their actions that day, which is phenomenal too.
Mm-hmm. Pretty crazy. Really impressive.
All right, let's move on to round number three.
That was a great analogy, like a work day. Just think about like your work day. The whole day, start to finish, is just nonstop crazy.
That is crazy to think about.
Round number three is going to be brought to you by our good friends at Movember. I actually might do it. I think now that I'm shaved, I might go full mustache. I look terrible with a full mustache. There's some people that can pull it off.
Yeah, like, but aren't you curious? Like, it's been a while.
No, that was Kate's nice way of saying, like, yeah, maybe you should do something different.
I mean, I might as well. Be better. What could possibly go worse for me? Like, what can people say on the internet if I look bad with a mustache than not? Like, but you do have certain people, like Gardner Minshew for the Jags, who looks phenomenal with it. He looks
hot patooties.com.
Dan, Big Cat, looks great with a mustache.
Sure.
Munchtown Bob here, who is famous for his munching properties.
Now, but the problem is when you get noticed for a Movember. My favorite thing is when Movember's over and everybody who had a really thick mustache, you would have a good mustache.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think I have a thinner, like, the line of a good mustache is how big your nose is to your lip.
Yeah.
If it's big, it looks better. Mm-hmm. If it's small, you look like a little shit.
Yeah.
But either way, if you do Movember, you can just do it for a little bit of the giggles. Make sure that you go to Movember and you join our team, because the Barstool Movember team is going to help change the face of men's health. For every $50 that we fundraise on our team, you get an entry to win a trip for $2, or for two, to join us at the Army-Navy game, which we're going to have a big tailgate for. Head to Movember.com/Barstool to join our team. Grow your mustache and fundraise for your chance to win some of the grand prizes. Also, last week we said that if you tweet at us at ZeroBlock30 on Instagram or tag us in it on Instagram at ZeroBlock30, that we would see some of those. Some of those young corporals,
whew,
they look good.
I used to love a good military mustache, because I feel like there's only so much that, like, us ladies, like, yeah, we can do a couple different fun buns and, like, do some, but you guys are pretty much stuck with the same shit.
Right.
So I feel like the mustache is the only razzle-dazzle, really, and if you're not taking advantage of it, you're missing out.
Now, while it may be within regs to have a mustache in the military, I know plenty of NCOs, I don't know how you feel about this, chaps, still were like, no, don't do that.
I didn't allow it.
Yeah. Oh,
well, still, I say go against the man. Grow that razzle dazzle.
Yeah, now
schnazzle.
I look back and, like, I kind of regret it, because it's not that serious. If you're in garrison or whatever, you're back at home, like, grow it out, especially if you're doing it for a good cause. If you are a military member listening, you're like, why you look nasty with your mustache? But like, well, actually, I'm doing stuff for Movember. You don't care about men's health, Sergeant?
For a good cause. Wow. It's for a good cause.
Get a clue, Sergeant.
Yeah, indeed. Seriously, grow up, bitch.
Excuse me, Sergeant. I want to tell you why I'm doing this.
Oh, this recruit actually joined so he could help people, and Movember helps people too. Sorry. See you later, Sorry. Love you, bye.
All right, let's move on to round three.
All right, round three, you actually had to explain this to me, because I did not fully understand
not
this at all.
Not a mansplain.
No, it wasn't
just
a
regular mansplain. Just a regular explanation.
Just a millsplain. He had to millsplain this to me. But basically, this story.
She came up to me, she's like, Stassard, I don't really understand round three, Stassard.
Putting medals on her kingdom,
But you get these medals, right?
Right.
So in the U.S. Air Force, if you're serving in cyber, space, intel, surveillance, or recon, and you're doing it remotely, so like you're piloting a drone, mm-hmm. or you're doing long distance intel where your computer work, whatever, you still get a campaign medal for it. But now they want to make it a remote combat campaign medal, so it'll still look the same, but like, explain this better.
It looks, it's a different medal altogether. This one's a different medal altogether, but there's two different things that they have. One, they're having a remote combat effects campaign medal. So for Marines, I think it blows our minds whenever we hear this. I don't know if you guys use it or not, but if you're flying a drone, you could be flying the drone in Iraq or Syria or Afghanistan, and you fly that motherfucker from Georgia. Mm-hmm. Like, not country of, state of. Right. And you could be inside the United States and still be technically part of a deployment. For a Marine, whenever we hear deployment, it's only counts as a deployment if you're in combat theater. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you're going on, like, a MU or something like that.
Right. I think it's probably a lot different now. When I was there, the only drones I saw were drones being flown by guys that were in theater.
Yeah, now they could do it a lot. I mean, obviously, technology is approved and shit like that. But basically, it's just surprising to hear that you can be part of a, quote, deployment and still be back. Well, now they're going to have a campaign medal because you were in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom or Enduring Freedom or whatever. They're going to have an award that recognizes that. I have no problem with that. It's the other one that they're going to roll out soon, that they're going to have an R device, and those are going to be if you participated in one of these Remote Combat Effects campaign and you get an award. For example, like Kate brought up that she got a Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medal while she was in Afghanistan. There's nothing on her device that indicates that she got it in a combat theater. You can get that for instance, having your entire barracks field day, like whenever there was an inspection that came through from the base general and you did a great job and you're the NCO.
You crushed the unit Christmas party planning. You did the unit, so I have the same award as that. And
Or you're part of like the base Iwo Jima reenactment type of thing. You can get a NAM for that.
Right.
So there is a huge difference of I got this one while I was deployed or I didn't, you know? Like the Bronze Star and the Meritorious. What's the one that's equivalent to the Navy Marine Corps medal is equivalent to a Bronze Star. The Bronze Star for Marines signifies that it happened in a combat tour.
Right.
Well, they want to make it where if you get one of these awards while you are on one of the Remote Combat Effects campaign medal, then you have an R device. But to me, that's just like, I'm a pogue. Like,
right.
Why would you do that?
Explain it how you explained it to me again. And so it's like you get this cool medal. But then there's this like little, it looks like a little speck. You get like this little.
Yeah, it's an R.
Like a V. Like a valid device.
Like I have a NAM with a V on it. So instead of having a NAM with a V, they'll get a NAM with an R. But I don't think that that's necessary.
But it lets people know like I was stateside.
Yeah.
I didn't deploy.
Like, I feel like it's a pogue identifier.
Yes. I think it's now going to be a problem. Well, not a problem, but it's going to identify these people as people who are not actually in theater. And then it gives them just that added weight of, ooh, I don't feel like I did as much. Maybe.
Right. It, like, adds an extra weight to them that because they might be self-conscious.
Like, yours, whenever you got yours in theater, should there be a combat T, like that you got a NAM in theater? Like, I'd be okay with that because I think getting awards in combat is a little bit different than getting them back at home. But that being said, I'm trying to get this by reading the Air Force manual. If we fucked it up, let us know.
Yeah,
if
seriously.
We fucked
yeah,
it up.
It was very confusing the way it read.
Yeah, yeah. Or if you're confusing. In one of these, if you're in one of these jobs, cyberspace, intelligence, surveillance, or reconnaissance where you're getting it away, reach out. We want to know what you think about that because we would love to issue a correction. Be like, hey, we were wrong. It wouldn't be the first time.
You know what?
I would also like to say, I think it's very important what these people do.
Yeah,
especially
it's definitely
in 2019.
Important. That's why I don't want to be like, this is a pogue award. Because if I saw that, dude, if you put me back in Staff Sergeant Cawthorn mode and somebody came up to me and I'm like, what the fuck is an R? And they're like, well, I got it because Staff Sergeant, I was in Georgia driving a drone.
Like, it's like you feel like you have to explain yourself.
Right.
I'll tell you, though, I think the one Air Force medal that they should be working on is the sports medal.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
she sat
the
down and conducted business. She pushed, she observed, repeated, took time, and secured that toilet before she dropped the bomb.
And we are also going to secure round 3 and move on to round 4. All right, round number 4, we're not going to spend too much time on it, but we did want to address it because the Marine Corps issued a statement that said they were going to change the way that promotions are going. The letter that came out from the Commandant is a little bit confusing because you had some issues with it, right?
Well, can I say first, traditionally how promotions work in the military is same in the civilian world. You invite your boss over for a dinner with the family, mm-hmm. make a nice meatloaf, maybe send him an edible arrangement or her.
Suck his dick.
Yeah, you might.
Or clit.
Or clit. Yeah. Whatever it is. Tug on those flaps. Whatever you got to do.
Yeah.
Nipples get twisted, all sorts of cool stuff. But traditionally, it's, you know, you schmooze. Mm. You schmooze or you lose. Now, oh no, that's not how.
Yeah, that's not how it
goes. That's a
so the Marine Corps issued a statement that beginning on January 1st, 2020, the time service requirement, which means how long you've actually been in the branch of service that you're in. Requirement for promotion to sergeant will increase from 24 to 48 months. So now you're eligible technically if you're a corporal already and you've met all the other requirements that you could be promoted to sergeant at 24 months. That's pretty quick.
So like, you only have to be in the military. You don't have to be a corporal for 2 years to get promoted to sergeant. You just have to have been in the military for 2 years to be a sergeant now.
Right. And
Isn't that crazy? Pretty fucking fast.
And they're also going to move the time and service requirements for staff sergeant will increase from 48 months to 60 months. The time and grade requirement will increase from 27 months to 36 months. What's that means that you have to be a sergeant for at least 36 months before you can go on to be a staff sergeant. So even if you got it at the very beginning, if you went 48 months and then you have to wait 36 months, you're really looking at 7 years before you can pick up staff sergeant.
No, I don't think so. I think because you only have to have been in for 2 years total to hit sergeant.
Right. I'm saying if it goes from it will increase from 24 to 48 months. So 48 months will be the first time that you're eligible by the promotion board to pick up sergeant.
4 years.
Yeah, 4 years. And then you have to be in that time and grade for 36 months before you can pick up staff sergeant.
But basically, long story short, they're just making it, they're shifting it and making things a little bit longer. You have to have been in a little bit longer to get these promotions, and then you have to be in that rank a little bit longer to get the next one.
Do we know what the impetus was for this?
I think it's because a lot of times people who get promoted quickly, the Marine Corps has a big issue with who they promote to corporal and sergeant. I think that we are better at identifying who should be staff NCOs and above, but we are not as good as identifying who should be E5s. We focus way too much on your ability to shoot, your ability to run fast, and your ability to do like shit like that, like
those would be further down on my list if I'm talking about promotions.
We don't talk about positions. It's not nearly as much as technical and tactical proficiency.
Right. Also, too, certain depending on your job, certain cutting scores are super low. So, say I'm just picking one like your bulk fuel, it might be easier for you to get promoted than infantry was notoriously difficult to get promoted in. You just had longer regs. Same with military police was notoriously long to get promoted and other ranks. So you see somebody else doing a different job and they're doing like sometimes you felt like less than you, but they're getting promoted way faster. And you're like, what the fuck?
You have some admin corporal telling you what to do, and even though they've been in for like 2 years and you've been in for four.
So it kind of, I think maybe this is a way to sort of even that out a little bit. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I would agree. Overall, it's probably a good thing, but I was always a big proponent of you train to standard, not to time. So I think I think this hurts the high speed people.
I do too.
And it will discourage people. It's like, well, I got to wait out this time anyway, so I don't know.
Well, no, the good news is this does not affect meritorious promotions. So if you're still shit hot, there's still a loophole.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah, there's still a loophole for you there. So,
but the meritorious promotions, those aren't like,
they're not like handed out like candy. Right. They're pretty rare. Right. Yeah.
So, but I mean, that's a pretty technical talk, but I think it is important because you have these leadership lessons. I think it's more important to be able to identify who's really good at their job. Yeah. That should be much more important. And I wish if I could go back and change so many things, it would be I focused on that, those small things whenever I was a leader, like who's running fast, who's shooting well, because those are easy to put on a board like, oh,
yeah, it's black and white. It's easier to defend.
She's a 300 PFT. She shot expert 3 times in a row. Let's fucking promote her when she or he might fucking suck at their job.
Right.
Don't suck at your job. Somebody who didn't suck with their job is Guy Songrass, who is a Navy commander. He's our interview in round number 5. He was also Secretary Mattis's head speechwriter while he was the Secretary of Defense, Top Gun pilot. He did all kinds of different shit, an incredible career. His book is amazing. Go get it on Amazon at Holding the Line. There's been lots of articles, but you got to read some of this shit for yourself because it's incredible. And then you can listen to the man himself. Here he is. All right, now in Zero Block 30, we've done the introduction, but we have Guy Snodgrass, Commander, United States Navy, former speechwriter for General Mattis, Secretary Mattis, I guess we should call him. I always think that's kind of strange for them to go back and forth because I think now he's going by General Mattis, right?
He's reverted back to General.
I don't know what I would do because Secretary, it's kind of like demoting yourself. I got out of the Marine Corps as a staff sergeant. I don't think I would ever go back. Like, actually call me Corporal. That was my favorite time that I got. But Guy, before we get into the book, because that's what everybody wants to hear about, I want to establish a baseline with our listeners because they're going to see these clips. They've already seen a lot of the clips that have come out from like the Washington Post, the New York Times about your book. But I want to establish that You spent 20 years in the Navy, not just writing speeches, but being an actual warfighter. Can you tell us a little bit about your career?
Sure, thanks. And thanks again for having me on the show. And like you mentioned, as all of us who've served in uniform know, I mean, sometimes you have a kind of an interesting sidebar career path, like being a speechwriter or doing something unique, but 89% of your time is spent operational and downrange. So like you mentioned, I was a 20-year Navy officer. So I was in the Navy for 20 years as a fighter pilot. Started out in the F-18 Charlie, which was the Legacy Hornet. Over time, I moved into the F-18 E and F, which is the Super Hornet variant. Started off, wound up getting the honor and opportunity to go to the U.S. Naval Academy up in Annapolis, Maryland. As soon as I came out of there, you know, just like the postcards and the advertisement they used when I was a kid, it's like, you know, accelerate your life. And I felt like that was the case, because just by going to the Naval Academy and then suddenly you get this opportunity to go to grad school. So I went to MIT for a couple of years. And I think that's where, you know, they kind of plant the seed, not only for independent thought, but also in your superior's mind. They're like, hey, you've got some broadening experiences. You can do a little bit more for us than just be a pilot. So once I finished up at MIT, I went through pilot training, bounced around from Pensacola, Florida, where I started doing the academics, went to a place called Vance Air Force Base in Oklahoma, where I flew my first jet aircraft, and then ultimately was selected to be both a fighter pilot and then, of course, an F-18 pilot. So I was in Lemoore, California for that. Got selected for my first career tour, or at least my first operational tour, and they sent me to the other coast, out to Oceana, Virginia, where I flew combat missions over Iraq during part of Iraqi Freedom. It was during the period of time around 2003, 2004, we were retaking Fallujah. So I had that experience. And of course,
so a lot of people, whenever they hear fighter pilot, I think you think of the F-18 is what comes to mind. And every time that I was deployed, I was in Fallujah as well. I can't imagine what it's like being over an area that has an active ground conflict and you're by yourself. Whenever you're flying over a combat area completely alone, essentially, what's going through your mind as a fighter pilot?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's basically 180 out from what you just mentioned. We knew, without a shadow of a doubt, there were active ongoing ground operations. We get called in routinely for shows of force, and it was basically get as low and as fast and as loud as you can.
And I loved it when it would happen.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you just want to scare the bad guys out of there so that the friendly forces could continue on with the mission. And then, you know, I had to employ at various times. I mean, there was one mission run where I used the entire complement of around 500 bullets I had in the Gatling gun to help out some Army troops that were taking fire from an apartment complex. So you're right. I mean, it was interesting, but we knew, I mean, by and large, by this point, there wasn't much of a surface air threat, maybe some RPGs now and again that would come up at you. But other than that, we knew we had it relatively easy. So we felt like our job was to make sure that the guys and gals on the ground had every single thing they needed to be successful and, frankly, to save their life.
And we thought about that too, whenever you guys would be going overhead, like how scary it would be if we were in a conflict that both sides had the ability to have F-18s or, God forbid, an A-10 like coming at you.
Oh, man.
It's scary. But I think that's important in the context of what we're going to talk about here, that you did serve and did 20 years, because there's been a lot of things that are going to come about in the news about your book. After you finish up your time in Japan, then you went to Norfolk, Virginia, correct?
Well, so yeah, I mean, I had a couple things in between there. I finished up the time, like we talked about, Fallujah, went out to be a Top Gun instructor. So did that for 2.5 years, had a tour of duty.
Did you wear a leather jacket?
Training officer. Oh, of course, leather jacket, dog tags, all the works, and, you know, beach volleyball. You know, and if you think about my entire career arc, the time at Top Gun probably was the most transformative, just because, I mean, an absolutely professional organization. And the greatest thing about it was that it was actually run by the junior officers, right? So it wasn't a bunch of Navy captains or colonels or running around telling you what to do. It was the lieutenants and the Marine Corps captains who were the ones coming up and leading the organization. And then the senior officers were rightfully so, and in a very positive sense, they were the top cover. So I did that. I had a chance to be a speechwriter for the Chief of Naval Operations. And then I had my own command of an F-18 squadron in Japan the second time I was out there. And that all kind of leads me back around to how I landed, like you mentioned, in Norfolk, Virginia. I was serving as an executive assistant there, and then got the call to come up and work with Secretary Mattis in the Pentagon.
So when you get that phone call, because you obviously did some pretty high level stuff and some pretty prestigious positions, like going to the Naval Academy, prestigious, going to MIT, prestigious, firing an F-18, getting selected to that. Which one was the most difficult for you to remain humble after getting the call?
You know, that's an interesting question. If you think about I was blessed. I had great parents. My dad, my mom were both putting service before self kind of people. My community was that way. My church was that way. I never saw getting a prestigious call or getting the opportunity to really challenge yourself and do something that would be exciting. It's something that you know, your ego would grow. And regardless, I've been married for about 15 years now, and my wife never let that happen in the first place. But it's just fascinating. You realize very quickly along that pathway that 90% of the time when you're getting the opportunity to do something pretty cool, it's because you've had men and women to the left and right of you who've either vouched for you or they've worked incredibly hard on your behalf. I mean, it's a team effort, as you know.
And you don't get to that position where you have, because I imagine working with the Secretary of Defense, they went through all your write-ups. They went through all your career evaluations. You don't get to that spot without being very trustworthy, without having stellar remarks all the way across the board. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. And as you know, I mean, a lot of times it's people personally vouching for you. The former Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Greener, had placed a call saying, look, this guy's great. He can't be overtasked. Another admiral said, hey, if you want someone like you mentioned, trustworthy, this is the guy you want. So I was honored they said that, and it was an honor to get the call.
Now, did you think whenever you got there, because I quoted, we talked about it a little bit on last week's episode, whenever we began talking about your book, that there's a scene from The West Wing. Have you ever watched The West Wing?
Just one or two episodes.
Okay, so there's a scene in The West Wing where one of the speechwriters, I believe it is, both of these gentlemen work for the legislative office inside the White House, and they get fired. And the chief that's in charge there says, now it's time for you to go write your book. When did you think that you were going to write a book? When did that process come about?
Well, you know, let's be honest. It was funny. When I walked into the office, you've already had some of the, you know, you could be relatively apolitical as a military officer or enlisted civilian. It doesn't matter. I mean, you knew that you were living a historic moment in time with Donald Trump earning and Americans' confidence. He's now the president of the United States. Mattis, who a lot of people revere, is the Secretary of Defense. And you knew it was very interesting. And we had a 2-star admiral and a retired 1-star admiral in the front office with me. And they would joke continuously, like, hey, make sure you're taking great notes. Make sure you're paying attention. You get to write the book one day. So it was interesting because I was still on my career path. I was headed upward and onward. And I, you know, I continued to catalog my thoughts. I kept a personal journal because I knew, hey, 10 years, 20 years on the road, this is such a fascinating period of time. I'd love to write this story. I just certainly never anticipated I'd have the opportunity to do it this quickly.
So whenever you, because now the book's out, like we're doing this interview, the book's out, and there's been press that's been great about it. You've seen, I'm sure, military members who are excited to read it like I was. And you've seen some that are like, I can't believe that he did this, that he betrayed Mattis in a certain sense. Secretary Mattis put out a statement that questioned your honor, essentially. Mm-hmm. When that statement came out, what was your guttural reaction? Did you expect that kind of blowback?
I would tell you it wasn't unanticipated. As part of the backstory of putting the book together, you know, in January of this year, I had actually called my boss and said, hey, Mr. Secretary, you know, I'm planning on doing this. I feel like I learned so much from the experience. I'd like to give back. And as he knows, I mean, we all learn and grow significantly by reading the experiences of others. I mean, he himself has written his own book that's out right now, and he's had some previous books that he's participated in prior to that. So I felt real excited about the project. I knew I learned a lot. I was adamant I was going to take an apolitical approach. I didn't want people to claim, hey, you're too right, you're too left. I just wanted to say, this is what I saw. And of course, from my background as a fighter pilot, I knew that the most important thing is, what lessons could I learn from this? What could I hand off to the people who I know are always coming in behind me who could gain from this experience? So that was my mindset. But you're right, it was a bell ringer. When your former boss, the guy you spent 17 months, you know, putting in 14, 15 hour days, working to make him as successful as possible, because that's certainly the right thing to do, you know, had written a fairly, you know, pretty rough remarks in response to me writing the book. And then, of course, you got your 10-year-old son in the kitchen with my wife and I saying, like, well, why would Mr. Mattis say that? You know, and you're trying to work your way through an explanation for it. But not unanticipated, a little bit disappointing, but, you know, I understand his point of view.
And I think that you're right, because you even profile in the book how he has 7,000 books that he read or that he has for himself, and having these stories, this story would probably be one that's on his shelf if he was reading about the life of a previous Secretary of Defense. I want to jump into some of the stories that you talk about in the book. One is that Mattis for years has said that he wanted to remain apolitical after he got out of the military, and he thinks that's the responsibility of the generals. I thought it was really interesting how you point out that he was kind of upset with General John Allen and with General Flynn whenever they didn't do that. Do you think that he ever saw like the hypocrisy in himself, like taking a political position in the Trump administration and being a general? Do you think that that ever crossed his mind, or he just looked at himself as different?
I'm not sure. It's an interesting way to look at it. I think he probably looked back. I mean, we had a picture of George Marshall on the wall right above his desk, someone who had successfully transitioned from his time as a general, and they got, of course, pulled in to be Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, you know, with President Roosevelt. So he's a student of history, and he has a depth of knowledge. I think sometimes, it's just easy. You put yourself out there. He wanted to, no doubt, for my time serving alongside him, there's no doubt in my mind he did it for the right reasons. He knew he was in a time of significant political turmoil. The military had been just beat down over the course of about a decade. You got the high op tempo from the war on terror, reduced budgets, a lot of people leaving uniform. It was a challenging time, and he wanted to help rebuild the military, and he felt compelled to come in and do that.
And there's a lot of things that happened throughout his time in the administration that I imagine caught you all off guard, his entire staff and him very personally. One of those was the transgender ban. I can't imagine, as a former Marine general that was in charge of CENTCOM, that he loved finding out huge policy decisions via tweet. Can you kind of talk about those experiences in the office?
Sure, you bet. I mean, in this case, the one you're talking about, the transgender tweet. Yeah, so Mattis is a guy who is notorious for having a crazy work schedule, right? He's at his desk before 6 a.m. every morning. He would usually stick around to at least 5, if not 6 or 7 p.m. at night. And as a staff, we'd be there.
You don't get those bags under your eyes by taking a lot of naps.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's got a couple Samsonites hanging there. So, so he works hard, and we finally convinced him he could take a week off from leave, to take leave, so he could go home to Washington State and see his mother, who was in her 90s. So he goes home to see her, and man, you couldn't have timed it any worse. Where he's been gone just a few days, and we get the tweet out of nowhere. And the thing about it, and this is really one of those lessons learned, right, that I recount in the book, is that policy is whatever the President of the United States, the administration, and others want to make it. They were elected to their office. They bring appointed individuals in to serve and help carry out their agenda. And that's the agenda that they were put there to do. And so, you know, you can argue and debate whether you like or dislike a policy, but there's certainly one of the lessons learned is there's certainly a right way to do it. And that's usually like you and I've experienced in the military, where in any organization, military or civilian, what is your strategy? What's your goal? What do you want to accomplish? And what's the best way to get everybody aligned behind that goal? And that's how you get to success. And the danger here is whether it was transgender or the creation of a space force or stopping the international exercises, the military exercises we were doing in South Korea, all those things were surprises that came out of left field. And had we had forewarning, we could have coordinated with our allies and partners or even internally within the administration. So when you get cut off guard like that, not only is it tough for the administration to actually get to success, but it makes it really tough for everyone below to try, and you just don't know what's going on. You kind of vapor lock and you just start to shut down.
And I think people don't realize what goes into being a speechwriter for someone like General Mattis. You said that he's written books and he's given speeches all over the place. He had 40 years in uniform that you can kind of go off of his thought. Can you think back at a time where you wrote something for him for remarks, and maybe it might be a little bit political, where he said, make this stronger or tone this down a little bit? How do you find that balance?
Well, he's going to review 9 times out of 10. He's certainly going to get a chance to review his remarks. And I think the best compliment I ever received during the job, and it's funny because it sounds like it's so contradictory to what you'd expect. The longer I was with him, especially after the first 3 or 4 months, the less time I got. But it was because he knew that with our shared military background, he knew I got it, right? And I had two civilians.
And that's what you want as a military officer. Absolutely. You want little to no supervision. That's the phrase that you always go after.
Not only that, you want little to no supervision for yourself, because that gives you autonomy and flexibility and freedom to do a good job. But more importantly, you want to free his time up. I mean, he's the secretary, as we joked, he's the secretary of all defense because he has a global portfolio. So you don't want him spending 20-30% of his time each day trying to figure out how to write a speech. You love it when he can offload that to you and you're handling that, and he feels confident in you that you can, he can trust you to get the job done right. And that way he gets it, can take a quick spin through it, make a couple of tweaks and go from there. But just like you said, we do a lot of due diligence. We pull historic references. We look at MacArthur or Marshall or President Reagan or others who are notable. You know, how do they write compelling speeches? We'd write it. I'd send it up to the boss, and then he would take a look, and he could just write in the margins things, you know, hey, punch it up here, or I'd like to talk more about this there. And it worked out great.
And some of those remarks that you're making, are you thinking about these are going to be remarks that last history? Because you're going back and looking at MacArthur and others.
You bet.
Are you thinking that eventually somebody is going to be doing these and my pen is going to be on the halls of history?
You know, it's funny. Until you just said it, I didn't think about the fact that, like, one of my favorite speeches was the speech he gave to West Point. It was one of the speeches that I had first started working when I joined the team. Myself and my predecessor, a guy named Justin Michaelet, were the two lead, as we call it, the pens, right? You've got the pen for the remarks. And so I had read MacArthur's speech that he had given to West Point, his farewell address. I loved the way he kept going through and using the same duty, honor, country kind of rubric. And so for Mattis, I came up with this, you know, hold the line. You know, you stand there apolitical, unapologetic, holding the line. And I really like that. So it's funny you say that because you're right. 10, 15, 30 years from now, there could be someone who's kind of like me, who's going back looking at speeches saying, I want to quote Mattis's speech. And it's pretty cool to have that piece of history.
No doubt, because I think over the last, for the war on terror, essentially, he is the most beloved, probably military figure across the board, across all branches. He's probably the most beloved. I also think it's interesting that his nickname is Chaos and Mad Dog, but he comes across as very, very measured. Was there a time where you were working for him where you felt some of that measure might unravel a little bit, where it was like, okay, he's actually really fucking pissed right now?
Well, so that's the beautiful thing about working for someone for a year and a half. And not only that, like when you work on a small staff, it's challenging. You could be working for a one star and they've got three people to do everything. And so you're just, you know, running from one place to the other, trying to make it work. When you're on a large staff, like for a four star or for a service secretary or secretary of defense, typically each person can be just laser focused on their task. So for me, director of communications or speech writing, you could have someone who's just his aide, who's making sure that the schedule's being executed, his bag's where it needs to be, et cetera. So that meant I had a year and a half just to focus like a laser beam on him, to study him, to watch him, to be able to, and we all did this. There's like six or seven of us on his kind of in his inner sanctum. And you're right. I mean, he is stoic, he is measured, and he is incredibly disciplined. So he rarely, if ever, broke. I rarely heard him, you know, use curse words. But yeah, you could tell when he get aggravated. There was one time relatively early on, nothing to do with me per se. He was just very stressed with some things that had happened between the Pentagon and the White House. Of course, you know, at that stage back in 2017, North Korea is firing off, popping off ballistic missiles. So it was a stressful time. And I walked some paperwork into him, and he kind of looked at it. He wasn't pleased with what he saw, and he threw it, trying to make it land on his desk, but it went all over the floor. And it was just this awkward moment because I knew he was pissed. And he had just tossed this set of remarks, but now they're all on the floor. And it's like, all I want to do is pick them up, but I'll be damned if I will with them standing there. And of course, he's just not doing anything about it. So we just kind of stared at each other for a few seconds. And then, like you mentioned, I recount one time in the book where he got pretty frustrated because, you know, there was a typo in the speech. But, you know, those are few and far between. And I can tell you, in all honesty, it was a phenomenal experience when you think about what, when you're in a job like that, what you're exposed to. You're working with someone, like you said, who is a national treasure. People really respect and look up to Secretary Mattis. So you know you're learning a ton, and you're learning from someone who's very good at what they do.
Did you learn of how to deal with people who were in higher positions by watching how his disagreements that he would have with President Trump and how he would handle him? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. You know, it's interesting because in some respects, it becomes much more political, the way you operate. And so not necessarily the president per se, but certainly I recount in the book a time where Secretary Mattis pulled me. I mean, I was his plus one. I was the only guy there with him in a meeting with Secretary.
Not a bad
Senator
date to
John
have.
McCain. Nope, it's a pretty good date. So, but he made me pay, which was not nice. But you know, you get to Capitol Hill, and we're having this meeting with Senator McCain and his plus one. And it's fascinating because, you know, for me, I'm used to being in a ready room type of environment where, hey, you don't have time to mince words. You're very direct. You just tell people what you need them to know, and you and And then they act on it and you kind of clear the air real quick and you move on. And it was fascinating to see this lion of the Senate, Senator McCain, and this individual who has had such a storied military career, Secretary Mattis, and the way they would just kind of talk. And it was very diplomatic. It wasn't, hey, man, I need you to, you know, figure this one out and get it fixed. Like, let's go. It was more of just like they're using talking points at each other. But that's standard. I mean, that happens whether you're talking to a member of Congress, to your counterpart from France, or, you know, the president of Indonesia. I mean, it could be anywhere around the world. That's just, that's kind of how it operates at that level. So it's far less direct than you would expect. Of course, he was very comfortable being direct with those of us on his staff.
Oh, I bet. Throughout the process of writing the book, you came through a lot of difficulty actually getting it through the DOD's vetting process. Was there a time in that process that you were like, maybe I made the wrong decision? Because you have to, you're in the private sector now. You're not in the Navy anymore. So being in the private sector, you know, somebody, if you want to work in anything defense related, nobody has more connections than Secretary Mattis. Was there a point when it was a struggle to get it through that you're like, maybe I'm making the wrong decision here?
I wouldn't say, you know, getting it through. I actually struggled with that early on. You know, I told my aviators all the time when I was the commanding officer out in Japan, I was like, look, you got to be thinking 30 minutes and 300 miles in front of your jet. You can't just be thinking like, what's the next thing that's going to happen? So same thing here. Before I even started writing the book, I knew that it was going to be a potentially perilous path. And I tried to offset that by talking to a lot of my peers. I talked to individuals junior to me, senior to me. I talked to retired admirals and generals. I wanted to say, look, here's what I'd like to do, but what's the right way to do it? How do I do this and keep my honor clean? How do I do this and make sure that I can put something out there that will stand the test of time? So I felt like I had some phenomenal input as I was writing the book and getting over that kind of catharsis, right? You know, you're working through that process. By the time the book was finished and it needed to go in for security review, I felt very comfortable with the material in it. And then really, it was kind of the opposite. I mean, once it hit the Pentagon, it moved pretty quickly. All of a sudden, it stalled out. They wanted to start blocking it, prevent it from coming out. They wanted to pull three chapters out of the book. You know, so it started getting kind of silly. And that's where, again, just it's those lessons that the military itself teaches you. Hey, document everything. Make sure that you understand what the rules and regulations say. So if they quoted something at me, it's like, you don't know what you're talking about because I've already read it. I've got it right here. And this is what it says. So you could kind of use their own words against them. But to your point, look, I know Mattis is certainly a very big name, but I think that, you know, leadership is leadership. It's kind of, I guess, fake to claim that you're a leader if you're going to do it when it's only convenient. I knew that I had witnessed a piece of history. I knew that the way that Mattis handled the job was incredibly, you know, ethical. I thought the way he handled some challenging situations was really just terrific to witness, and it was worth sharing that with the American public.
And I think that your praise throughout the book, because that's, I read some of the criticisms that came out before I read the book, and you couldn't be more almost centered on praising the secretary than like trying to be like a gotcha type of book. I didn't get that feel from it at all. The way that you admire Mattis speaks out loudly in the book. Now that you've released the book and you've heard some of his comments, it's got to sting. Like those comments yesterday, the way that they were written from him, like, I haven't read it. He's a low-level staffer. He surrendered his honor. Those kind of things, that shoots right to the heart of who you weren't for 20 years of your naval service. It had to sting like hell.
Yeah, of course it stings. I mean, like you know, when you asked earlier and I said, hey, it's challenging, right? Because you
– yeah.
And not only that, I mean, look, he owes me nothing – but it's one of those things where when you're putting in the long hours, when you're pulling out all the stops, when you've moved from place to place to place, and finally you're in a place, you've been there for 3 months, and in our case, Norfolk, Virginia, where the family can finally rest. You know, we've been through all these high op-tempo stops in our career, and now, hey, we can be here for at least 2 years, if not longer, when I got selected for Air Wing Command. But hey, we can give the kids stability for the first time, and to get asked to uproot yourself 3 months into that, and then suddenly take a high up tempo job again in the Pentagon where you're just basically never home and Sarah becomes a single mother again. That was rough. And so to see those comments, they do sting because you know how much you put into it, but that's fine. There's no law or regulation that says that your boss has to be, you know, nice to you. And I don't think it diminishes anything about who he is. I mean, he's still a fantastic general. He's still a great guy. And I know the signal he's trying to send here. What I would say, though, is it is fascinating to me, to your point earlier, that, you know, if you look at what he said in that letter, right, it's like, hey, you kept notes, you wrote a book, and you did less for me than you claim you did. And it's like, it's kind of ironic, because that's exactly what President Trump has said about him, right? Like, Secretary Mattis is the most overrated general in history. You know, he's out there writing a book. So look, if that's the way it is, then I'm in good company.
Yeah, I encourage everybody to read it. I just finished it up. Like I said, it's a fantastic read if you like history, if you like General Mattis, if you like a little bit of drama. I said earlier that I think now we might need to spell chaos with a K, because a lot of it lately has felt like the Kardashians. So. But thank you so much, Bus, for joining us. We appreciate your time. Good luck on the book tour. I know it's going to be a long and arduous one, but thank you for your service in 20 years in the Navy.
Yeah, thanks, Chaps. Thanks for having me, and I appreciate the opportunity. Take care.
One of the things I was surprised by most was that from what you saw in the news, they kind of gave this impression that the book was like shitting on Mattis, and that it wasn't, and, you know,
you're telling me something on the news was misleading?
He actually really admires General Mattis, right, and really was complimentary of him, so it's kind of...
extremely complimentary.
Yeah, it was different than what I thought it was going to be, so...
Yeah, there's a lot of parts of the book that I thought were unbelievable that... like whenever you go through just the decision making that has to take place in the moment and how you weave yourself in and out of a difficult situation with somebody who's your boss and is the commander in chief, and you might not agree and you have a lifetime of experience behind why you disagree, has got to be so tough.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what you're used to. You're also used to that as a general, because Mattis was never the commandant of the Marine Corps. He's never the chairman.
He was always answering to somebody.
Somebody. You have to always answer to somebody. And I think that he served that position well. There's going to be people who agree with him that don't agree with him on the way that he's doing things, but that's just the way the cookie crumbled. But I bet if Guy could say that he made one change just after talking to him for just 30 minutes and then we talked for a little while after, I bet that he really regrets of all of his time that he spent at the Pentagon not having the Calm app on his phone. Because struggling to sleep these days? You're not alone. One in every three U.S. adult doesn't sleep well. And if you're not sleeping enough, it can affect your cognitive functions during the day, like learning, problem solving, and decision makings, which will help you if you're in a speechwriter role or if you're the Secretary of Defense. Everybody needs to make good decisions. Like, Kate, you should put it on your phone, because I'm getting kind of concerned about
I've seen
your
a lot of Insta stories, 2 to 3
night,
in the morning and during the week.
3 o'clock in the
it's
morning.
It's one thing to be gallivanting about on the weekends.
I know.
On school nights, not so much.
3 nights in a row, I haven't drifted off till about 4 something in the morning.
Have you downloaded it?
I have. And I've tried the free. They have like a couple like trial run stuff too. If you're like, oh, I'm not sure, give it a whirl. Check
How
it out.
How close do you sleep to your phone?
Oh, God. The probably the reason I don't is because I keep it right next to my head.
Yeah, you should make a commitment to the listeners to keep it across your room.
All right. And the nice thing is you can listen on your Bluetooth speaker. You don't have to have the phone right next to your head, whatever.
So if you want to get it right now, ZBT listeners can get it for 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/ZBT. That's calm.com/ZBT. 40 million people have downloaded Calm, to include our beloved Kate Filet Mignon, and find out why at calm.com/ZBT. Let's move into some save rounds alibis. Do you have any, Connor?
Number one, I've been bleeding this entire episode.
Saw that.
Powered through, started bleeding right before we started recording.
I'll send
you
got
one of those
medals.
Little, you know, you get those little chips on the end of your nail and you pull it and all of a sudden all the skin on your finger comes off.
That is a terrible situation.
But no, so this weekend, as you're listening to this, I am on my way to Jacksonville, Florida for the world's largest outdoor cocktail party with the Barstool Breakfast Crew, Willie Large and Pat. Jet Ski will be there as well. We are going to be hanging out, sponsored by our friends over there at Bud Light. So if you are in the Jacksonville area, please come out, say what's up. Chaps, I'm going to try to take them to the restaurant that we went to. Tell me a name.
Safe Harbor.
Safe Harbor. No free ads, but I think we might have to try to get to Safe Harbor if possible.
Get
but
the hot dogs. I heard they're good.
Yeah, great, the hot dogs are delicious, right, Kate? Yeah, but if you're in Jacksonville, come hang out with us.
Kate?
I went to the gym this morning again.
Is that it?
That's it.
Bren?
Shout out Conan.
Yeah.
The dog that was declassified who took down Al Baghdadi.
I was hoping it was a lady dog, I gotta say.
14 out of 10 would have let off the leash to bite the neck of a terrorist.
Mm-hmm. Chaps, what can you tell us, if anything, about that name?
Nothing.
Okay.
I don't know why it was classified at first, because like usually there's an indicator that has nothing.
Can you go into that just a little bit? Because I thought that was fascinating what you tweeted the other day about the names of working dogs.
Sure. So if you have working dogs, there was concern that it was going to be classified. And even there's a general, I forget what his name, Mark A. something. I believe he was an Army general. He tweeted out one of the most absolute nonsense tweets about military working dogs that I've ever seen. He said he made a three-part. I can't remember what his name is, but I remember what the tweet is.
General Milley, the chairman of the Chiefs?
No.
Okay.
Different Mark.
Yeah, different Mark.
Different Mark.
So he said, one, that they don't classify because if you know the dog's name, you know the handler's name, which is fucking insane. Like, how would you possibly know that?
I don't know.
Even if you had – even on, like – DOD kill sheets, the dog and the handler aren't paired together. It's a piece of equipment. It doesn't say who it belongs to.
And
it
who,
says the company or battalion that he
who
belongs
are
to.
They? Like, oh, they'll figure it out. Who's figuring it out?
Well, yeah, I don't know who they are, too.
ISIS people have access to the databases where this information
though
will be found?
I do hope it turns out that the soldier's last name is O'Brien. We've got Conan O'Brien taking out these fucking terrorists in here.
Yeah. So basically what it boils down to is that from that name, there wasn't. There is some indicators from dogs that are born on Lackland. Like, for instance, my dog, Sika. His name, I always spell it C-S-I-K-A. But in reality, it's C-C. So that indicates that it's a puppy program dog that
right.
was born on Lackland. And with a puppy program dog or a dog that's trained on Lackland, you know that they have not – that they are trained to find 9 different types of explosives. And – if you know what types of explosives those are, then you might be able to concoct different types of explosives that those dogs would have difficulty. It's really tough because we picked the 9 different types of explosives, and I often, when I used to do demonstrations, I would compare it to colors. Mm-hmm. Like if I teach you to find yellow and I teach you to find blue, you can find every shade of yellow, every shade of blue, and every shade of green, and all the different ones in between. So that's the way that we train it, and we do it with 6 drugs or 9 or 9 bombs.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So also, I want to say this dog, they're selling mugs and shirts.
And they're all ugly as fuck.
I know.
All those, like, we thought about doing it. That's just cheesy. Don't buy a Conan shirt.
Yeah. What is it doing for Conan?
Yeah. Conan's not getting any extra.
He's like a
kibble.
College athlete.
Yeah. But I hope he's feeling much better.
I do too.
Because there's nothing sadder than a sick working dog.
No.
That's the worst. When Sika, before we deployed, when I came into his kennel and he was super excited one night, I guess, he just spun around to the point where his tail was bleeding.
Oh.
Oh, my goodness.
And he, like, I walked into his kennel and it looked like a scene from Hostel.
Oh, yeah.
And Sika was just, like, laying on his side, like, breathing really deep. Like, you know, when you look at a dog and you could tell that they're smiling.
Right.
Like, yeah. He was real happy with himself.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like,
very pleased.
I'm like, you probably almost killed yourself. Dude.
Yeah.
Sorry, with the questions.
As we're talking about that, Kyle sent a picture into the group chat of Donald Trump putting. Is this a Photoshop of him putting like a Medal of Honor around?
Medal of Honor on Conan.
Yeah.
Chaps, in terms of working dogs and injuries, if you were out on a mission with Sika and Sika suffered an injury, does that mean you just didn't go out again until Sika was ready to go back out? Or depending on the injury, you get a new dog or what?
Yeah, there's a couple different types of dog units that you can use, like the IDD dogs. Those dogs were used just like equipment. Like, they didn't have any type to get rapport. But if Psycho was out, I was out. Like, I couldn't do anything else because we had trained together so much and shit like that. But yeah, that's it. It's on the retreat.